I don't understand how she trades so frequently either. Like, if Nvidia was a great bet, how do you change your logic on that?
I don't know.
Watch the thing go up five times and then start complaining about it being Cisco.
No, thong song.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
We got too much Eminem going on here. Today you came dressed like Eminem.
What, I can't wear a stocking hat in the house?
Not like this. You look straight 8 Mile up in this Jeezy today.
I had a tough week. There's 2 feet of snow outside. I feel like I'm in Detroit.
Why you got your mom's spaghetti on your shirt then?
I don't know what that means.
Oh, man. Life good on your side?
Not too bad. How about you?
Yeah. I'm going international again very soon. So we got to figure out. It would be bombs.coms if we could do another international recording. So if we can figure that out, bombs.coms. But we got to figure it
You're
out.
Making fun of my outfit over here? You just went bombs.com. All right. I feel like we got to talk. We got to give the people what they want.
Okay.
Which, of course, is a math quiz.
Ooh, fired up. Derivatives.
Dougals, if you order two 12-inch pizzas.
24 inches.
You know. And then you're like, you know what? I really don't want to carry two 12-inch pizzas. I think I just like maybe one pizza. What size pizza should you buy to get more pizza, just slightly more pizza than two 12-inch pizzas?
25-inch pizza.
An 18-inch pizza. Happy Pi Day, Dougals. We're a little late on this.
Oh, wait. Were you doing like circumferences and
yeah, whatnot? That's right.
Oh, man. Yeah. You brought the Greek letters up in chat? Okay.
A 25-inch pizza. Come on. I know you weren't serious with that answer.
Well, it's 20, 12 plus 12 plus 1. Keep it simple.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
Is today Pi Day?
314.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. I didn't think about that.
I mean, I never dreamed you were going to be so ignorant about Pi Day and size of pizzas.
One of my favorite days is Pi Day. So I'm also surprised. It's one of my top 365 days.
Barely makes the cut.
Barely makes the cut. Should I fishbowl this?
Yeah, I want to hop into it.
I don't like to throw out the word justified when not talking about incredibly, incredibly awesome shows very often, but I'm going to talk about Justified here. And also, I don't like to be justified in somebody else's shade. I don't like it. However, today it's going to happen because I want to talk about the 15 funds that have destroyed the most wealth over the past decade. Amy, Arnott, and Morningstar. Skippy, you and I'm dragging you into this, although it's mostly I, but you and I for... How long now? I don't know. However long we've been recording the show, I've been talking about while we respect the fact that she gets out there, she does her thing. Kathy Wood talking all the nonsense, even though she does that. And I respect the fact I want to see women in this industry. You got to beware of what she actually invests in. We've been talking about that for years now.
But hold on. You in our pre-show meeting, you said, I want to talk about the 15 funds that destroyed the most wealth. And I didn't say anything. I took less than a millisecond. I said, oh, ARK. Like, and I'm just looking at the list now. ARK is number 3. But before we talk,
yeah,
before we even go there, we have to talk about her comments this week where she's now calling NVIDIA a bubble and comparing it to Cisco in 1999. If Kathy Wood, the queen of all bubbles, she chews bubble issue scum nonstop, Dougals. All right. And if she's calling your stock a bubble, we have some issues.
Lots of issues. Here's what I love about this list. This list, if you take ARK out of it, so there are two ARK ETFs on this list. If you take ARK out of it, it makes perfect sense. Like no one will be surprised because it's all the I'll call them trends. It's a kind of a loose term that you'd expect. You've got short funds. So funds that have shorted the stock market have lost the most money over the last decade when we had this
and
huge...
like inverse leverage funds. I mean, yeah. Which is another flavor, but it's like in some cases in a bull market, these funds are made to lose money. And because you're betting against a trend And so to me, yes, are they destroying wealth using this author's term? Yeah. But like, is there a purpose behind it that's probably not creating the most wealth at this point in the game? Absolutely.
Exactly. You got those. You got commodities, which outside of the last couple of years has been really rough. You have China, which we've talked about how China is back to below. I don't know if it's still below, but around where it was 30 years ago as like an index. You have Russia, not a surprise. Like this is what you're working with. And so if you just quickly glance through this, you go, okay, that's not really news. I get it. And then you have a fund, two funds that were purpose built to ride a bull meme filled market. If you could choose funds based on their description, knowing what's happening in the macro and their description, it would be these funds. ARK Innovation ETF, ARK Genomic ETF. If you then scroll down in the article, there's the top 10 wealth destroying fund families. So this is when you bring in like who is the, not the fund itself, but what's the group that brought together the funds. And this is where, I mean, Kathy just rules the day. ARK
She's
ETF Trust.
Laps around the field.
Lappity laps. Down with lost $14.3 billion as of December 31st of last year, which is more than double the next fund family.
So, and there's fund families in here like ProShares, Barclays, AdvisorShares, GlobalX Funds. GlobalX Funds has almost $40 billion of assets. ProShares has almost $70 billion of assets. And Kathy Wood has destroyed more wealth. Let's use the author's term because it's incredible here. She has destroyed $14 billion worth of wealth. With a current size of only $16 billion. Like, this is truly legendary performance. Like, more wealth destruction than I could ever imagine.
And I think it's a lesson in a lot of things. And we've talked about Kathy enough on the show of she just invests in things that like where money, cash flow, that kind of stuff does not even matter at all. But the bigger thing is she is her ARK ETF has owned Tesla and NVIDIA during this time. If I told you...
I think there's a slight correction there. Tesla's had a rough couple months, but I believe she sold NVIDIA at like 200.
This is what I'm saying. It's not even just what she's buying, because she has owned two of the top wealth-creating stocks of this last decade. But she trades in and out of them like she's buying toilet paper. I don't even know what that analogy means. But it's accurate.
A pause for effect. At one point, multiple years ago, I was saying, gosh, I don't short stocks, but whatever Kathy Wood's doing, I'd like to short against that. And the conversation we had on the show was, but she trades stocks so frequently that you don't even know what you're shorting against. That's another point here is like, you cannot outperform if you trade stocks on a daily or weekly basis. And I don't follow her portfolio closely, but man, I don't understand how she trades so frequently either. Like, if NVIDIA was a great bet, how do you change your logic on that?
I don't know.
Watch the thing go up five times and then start complaining about it being Cisco.
I know. Thong song. I know. I've no idea. No idea. I wanted to hit on this one because it is like, again, when you look at the funds, they are funds that make perfect sense. A Russia ETF makes perfect sense that it would be on this list. And then you have ARK, which makes no sense to be on this list outside of the, like at the macro. At the micro, it makes perfect sense to be on this list as well. So that's all. That's my first fishbowl topic, right, Joe?
$14.3 billion estimated wealth destroyed for the ARK ETF Trust Fund family. Good job, guys. Round of applause. Good job.
I don't even know. I don't think there's a quick way to do this, but how much money has she personally made? That is probably the most anger-inducing component of this. Because if she's running, what is it, $16 billion? If you just take hundreds of millions.
It used to be $30 billion, and then 14 of it evaporated.
But she made money on all of that.
Yep.
All right.
Whew, enough of that. All right. Step down, Dougals. You're all right. Do we need to have a little heart to heart here? Kathy Wood, is you don't have to talk about her every day. Okay. We can move on.
We can move on.
Right. I'm moving on to some goodness. You're really going to like this. So Goodreads has an official breakdown of the top 100 most popular investing books. We're just going to talk about the top 10.
Okay.
First, I'm going to walk through the top 10. You're going to tell me how many of these you have read. Okay. Because if you haven't read enough of these books, Dougals, we're going to kick you off the podcast.
Well, all what's right? enough? One?
I don't I'm hoping you get to three or four. We'll see.
Okay. I don't know.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Number one, our boy, been on the podcast twice, William Green, Richer, Wiser, Happier. Great book if you haven't read it. This, this is best reviewed. So it has 4.53 stars out of 5 on Goodreads. You've read that one, right?
Yeah. So I've read 100% of the top rated book on investing on Goodreads.
Number two, The Simple Path to Wealth by J.L. Collins. I actually have not read this one.
I've not either. It's on the list, though.
Number three, Poor Charlie's Almanac.
I have now.
What do you think?
It's good. It's one of those got to pick up pretty frequently. Because he just says so many awesome things. It's also not, I didn't know how it was written. I'll say how it was laid out. It was surprising to me that it's his speeches, whatever, from the past. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Number four, Barefoot Investor, The Only Money Guide by Scott Pape.
No, I never even heard of this one.
This is a best-selling Australian book of all time. Not investing book. I read it this week. Pretty good. The Book of Rental Property Investing by Brandon Turner. Never even heard of this one at number five.
We're never going to read it. 0%
chance.
And we
don't care. Yeah, there's some other smucks talking about that. Good. Which podcast now? We don't care. Number six, Hedge Fund Market Wizards, How Winning Traders Win. Don't know
how winning traders win.
Yeah, how winning traders win. I mean, again, Hedge Fund Market Wizards, wrong podcast. I don't think. seven, The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel.
Yep.
Eight, I've read Margin that one. Of Safety.
It came out 4 years ago. I think I basically read it almost every year. Margin of Safety. I want to read this one. The problem is there were like six of these in print. It's
haven't read this one?
No, and I want to. I found it. I only found one copy, and it was like $400 because...
No, I'll send it to you.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I want to read it.
It's great. Nine, The Millionaire Fastlane, Crack the Code to Wealth. Again, Millionaire Fastlane's probably not showing up on this here podcast.
We just talked about The Millionaire Fastlane. You run a $30 billion fund and bring it down to $16 billion. You are a 100 millionaire. Done. All check.
And 10, The Most Important Thing by Howard Marks.
Yep, that's another almost every year read.
Okay, so I gotta count this up. I've only read six of the top 10, although three I have no interest in. So I might pick up The Simple Path to Wealth and see if there's anything good there.
Yeah, and I'm one behind you, I assume, because the Barefoot Contessa.
Well, and Margin of Safety, which you'll read.
I'm two.
I'll send it your way. You can read it on
then
your
I'll read plate. It. Yeah.
Okay. Not a bad list, though. And you're right. Like three or four of those, gosh, maybe even five of those, you could easily read every year and still get wisdom and still make money from them. Like that's the thing with, say, The Most Important Thing or Poor Charlie's Almanac. You can pick it up at any point in the market cycle and find some stuff that rhymes with the classic principles described there and go make some money. Like it's really a great investment.
Yeah, I like that. Millionaire Fastlane sounds Hedge Fund Market Wizard, How to Win When Winners Win, or whatever that one was called.
Yeah.
Like, just, I don't know.
To be honest, that probably describes the Dougal's long trend momentum philosophy.
It might. It might. Winning when winning gets tough, but you still win because winners win. The Dougal's autobiography. Can I reach in?
Yeah.
I'm all negative today, by the way. Just FYI. I'm coming in hot again. So, Charlie Bleulow tweeted out a few of the new hit points from the economic or the Bureau of Economic Analysis. First one I'm going to hit on is about interest. Oh, okay, here, people. Always, when you check debt levels, always numero uno for the debt levels is mortgage debt. From when you talk about households, that's the way it runs. What's changed now, for the first time on record, is that U.S. household interest payments on non-mortgage debt, so this is not the debt itself, but the payments on the debt, have hit a record $573 billion over the past year. So it's now higher than mortgage debt. So people are paying more interest on non-mortgage debt than mortgage debt for the first time ever. It's a pretty big deal. The reason—
I haven't done a deep dive here. Yeah, go ahead. Tell me more.
The reason this is because so many people have locked in low 3%-ish, you know, sub 4% mortgage rates, but credit card rates are not locked. So those have now jumped, right? So you're hitting credit card rates are in the 20s at this point, and people continue to rack up non-mortgage debt with rates that are increasing. That's why this has jumped over the past year. And it's a big, big leap. If you look at this chart, and we'll put on the Substack, skippydougals.substack.com, if you want to check that out. But if you look at this chart over the past year, it looks like NVIDIA. Like that's basically what it looks like. It's a vertical.
There's actually parallels here to the regional banking crisis, because effectively what you're saying is there's two different types of debt. One, which is longer term in duration. And in this case, because it's longer term in duration, it's locked in at lower rates. And one, which is much shorter term in duration, which is probably largely credit card debt, but it could be other sorts of short-term debt. It could be auto loans, which might have a 5-year term.
That's right.
It might be at 12%, you know, 9 to 12% these days.
That's right.
Which is just insane. Like, give me a personal call if you're thinking about taking out auto debt at 12%. I'd like to have a heart-to-heart with you, but this is bonkers. Certainly this graph goes back to 1978. It hasn't ever happened in that time period. And typically, non-mortgage debt has been about half the total value of mortgage debt during that time frame. And now it's greater than that. I tend to want to go immediately to the ramifications of this. I mean, it just means everybody's significantly poorer.
It's bad. It's the ramifications. It's bad. It's the same stuff we've been talking about for 2 years now. Has like been slowly building because debt continued to go up, but interest rates weren't that large. And so what people were saying, or people were tweeting, whatever, was two things. I know debt is increasing. However, if you look at the debt payments that folks have, they're manageable. That was one thing people were saying. The other thing people were saying is that when you look at the wage increases relative to debt payment increases, we're still good. I don't know about that second one. I can't comment on the second one at this point in time, but this is starting to show that the first argument is starting to fade. Now, interest rates, and by the way, interest rates, people are continuing to think that interest rates are high, and they're not high. Interest rates are normal, in a normal range right now. Mm-hmm. So interest rates get to a normal range, and now the debt becomes a problem. And people are betting on interest rates being cut. They don't even have to be cut. Interest rates just stayed the same, and they would just be in a normal historical range outside of the last 15, 20 years. So ramifications are bad.
Yeah. Are we being hyperbolic here, though?
I don't think so. No, because the issue, I mean, maybe, I don't know, you all be the judge of this, but we're only being hyperbolic if folks stop the trend that's happening right now. Meaning like, we're still using credit cards, we're still using buy now, pay later, we're still buying autos, right, that are, what were the payments? I'm trying to think of when we, remember you were going through like the average payments? And autos, and they're like $700 or something.
So the average payment is like $750.
Yeah.
They're like 30% of payments are above $1,000 a month, which is insane.
Yeah. I don't know what margin loans look like right now, but I bet they're probably down. Like that's one thing that is likely down. I hope it is. But I don't think it is hyperbolic. This is saying that the amount of debt continues to increase, and that was okay so long as interest rates were down. Now that interest rates are up, it's starting to become a problem.
I have a dumb question. The second tweet in this tweet storm breaks down the effective mortgage rate, which has significantly declined since 1978. And then the current average credit card interest rate going back again to 1978. And in the 80s, the current average credit card interest rate was maybe around 18%. And then it came all the way down in the low rate environment to like a low of 12. And in the early 2000s, the average credit card interest rate was around 12. And again, it's skyrocketed recently to like 22%, it appears. I understand some fluctuation with credit card interest rates, but it's like you said, I guess I assumed that if the Fed funds rate was at 18 in 1982, there'd be a fairly consistent delta between the Fed funds rate and credit card interest rates that has clearly exploded. I mean, we're in a normal rate environment. How is the average credit card interest rate 22%? And not to be like heavy-handed, like the government should step in, but how is that allowed? At what point do you get to proprietary lending standards when you just overnight go from an average rate of like 14, and I say overnight, I mean a 2-year period here, to 22%? Like, this doesn't seem reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I can't talk about the government part of this, but it comes in line with the concept that we've discussed a couple times here on the pod, how there's a portion of inflation that's being held up by corporate profits. What a credit card interest rate is it's the price that credit card companies are charging someone to lend. I mean, that's what it is. And so this is just saying that the credit card companies found out they need to charge more. Like that's what it is. They're passing along the price. Why the government allows it?
Oh, no. And let me just push back. I hear what you're saying, but Visa and MasterCard and others have great business models.
Fantastic.
They consistently make money for decades. They have high ROEs. Their lending costs are not that extreme. I don't know that I fully believe that that's like a market supported rate as much as it seems like it's a duopoly taking advantage of their consumers because they can. Maybe we need to pull some research on this.
Yeah, maybe. This is my ignorance. I think you know probably more about this industry than I do. I was not assuming that those rates are set by Visa and MasterCard, but rather the banks that are behind the cards themselves, because those are the processors.
Or the airlines.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good question. I actually don't know that off the top of my head, how much, what that partnership looks like, right?
Yeah.
If your Visa card came from a large regional bank, who actually determines the rate?
We should check that out. We'll come back with that. Okay. I assumed it was the entity that is running the card versus Visa or MasterCard, but we should check that out. We'll come back to it. Yeah. There's nothing good about this. Regardless.
No, it's super scary because if you follow the residential real estate world, it's doom and gloom like crazy, with everyone screaming, we can't afford a house because the interest or the debt payments on our loan are too great. And there's a lot of truth to that. But then when you say, and there's this whole other gorilla sitting in the corner, that's actually a bigger deal than that right now. It's crazy to think about. It really will have ramifications. I think it goes back to the political conversation we had last week, which is like all the metrics on the economy look great, but then there are these other things that don't get captured in your headline metrics. Like, yeah, maybe my credit card debt is insane and I continue to make minimum monthly payments while my interest rate went from 14% to 24%. Yeah. That doesn't make me feel good about life.
Exactly. And that doesn't show, to your point, that doesn't show up on any of the macro indicators.
Yeah, it's like, oh, so the unemployment rate is low and the stock market's performing. It doesn't, but my day-to-day feels horrible because this debt I'm carrying.
Yep. All right, what's your fishbowl?
Okay. FundSmith, in their annual meeting this week, has a slide, very interesting slide, with examples of good and bad businesses. I want your take on this. Basically, the way they break down a good business, they look at the delta between a company's return on capital employed versus the weighted average cost of capital. Apologies here because we get like deep in finance land. But effectively, they're saying how profitable is a company based on capital efficiency, that's the return on capital employed, against the weighted average cost of capital, which would be like a discount rate. Trust me here that I think the logic behind the scenes is sound. What I'm really curious about is some of these industries that get named as the highest deltas with that ratio and the lowest, okay?
Yep.
So let's continue on your arc theme and talk about the worst first. The worst couple ones are brokerage and investment banking and banks and financial services and oil and gas. Best industry, tobacco, high profitability with very little capital employed. They're not like... Mm-hmm. building new factories. I mean, maybe to manufacture Zen, but that's it.
Exactly.
Followed by information services. Same deal. You almost need to deploy no capital to get a solid return. And then we have healthcare, advertising, computer services, and beverage soft drinks. I just thought this was an interesting way to look at
it. Yeah, it is. I'm surprised on the financial front, on the worst side. Those are the ones that surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
Like over the last decade, non-bank, non-insurance financial services had a 0.5% return on capital employed. That was a really surprising view.
Well, but you have to, if you're in lending, you have to invest a lot with putting up capital to make a return in a really low interest rate environment.
But it's non-bank. So what's included maybe in there? Because I was assuming that one was more like, I don't know, what is Ken Griffin's? Citadel.
Oh,
like the Citadels and the hedge funds. Like that's what I was assuming was in there, but maybe we could check. But that one was surprising to me. The REITs are all over. Real estate, REITs are all over the right side of this. That was the least surprising part of this chart for me. Financial services were very surprising. Also, household products on the left. For best businesses, household products as an industry?
I'm thinking of that as like P&G, Procter & Gamble stuff, which tends to be pretty high margin. Like Tide detergent and stuff like that. I think the profit margins would surprise you.
I wonder how much of businesses that exist today are not like if you look in semiconductors, something along those lines. Like where do those fall? Or Microsoft, where does that fall from an industry? Like what's the industry that it falls within? I'm really curious about in here. And mostly what I'm thinking about is when you have return on capital employed for businesses that it's hard to explain, like where capital isn't when this metric isn't a thing that you necessarily like look at, when like return on equity, you know, is a thing you'd look at. It's fascinating to me. I think I want to do a little more research into how they thought about this. Because I agree with you that I'm sure that the work behind this is absolutely sound. And I'm curious, I'd want to like read the full report to get a sense for what's included, what's not included.
I support that. So this actually comes from Professor Damodaran at NYU.
That's my boy right there.
Thing. We should dig in to the actual analysis. The other thing, I think I did a poor job setting this up, is this is from 2013 to 2002. So it's a whole decade worth of data here. Let's dive in. We might touch on it in another episode. I just thought this was a interesting analysis, and then it makes you think in a way. These aren't my favorite metrics, but I understand why you might use them, and it makes you think about industries in a different way. Basically, what industries have a high gauge of profitability with a low amount of investment, and that almost goes like there's a parallel here to like Buffett talking about See's Candy.
Yep.
Profit margins are there, demand remains strong, and in order to grow revenues greatly, you don't have to invest a bunch of capital to do it.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is probably like a starting list for a Buffett-esque style investment philosophy, where these are businesses that are easier to understand. Like there is capital that goes out, and then what comes in. There's none of the funny business when I was bringing up like Microsoft and whatnot. Like it doesn't get complex in how you think about that. Like these are businesses you want to own outright. Like you actually want to own this business. It's not just like an investment, I would say, because there's less worry about technology trends and all that. You're just like, I want to buy the entire healthcare support services industry, because that is amazing. Like that, it's very Buffett.
The one in the best businesses list, the industry that is a little surprising to me, is it's listed as retail building supply. Well, there's apparently 98 firms that fall into that. I mean, are we talking like Tractor Supply Company? I think we need to dig deep, because what's behind these numbers, I think, is really fascinating. But hey, tobacco is highly profitable. Now, there's other issues. Information services, I'm not at all surprised to see at the top of this list, because once you build the thing, if you build a subscription model, like you can grow the revenue, you can grow your revenues by thousands of times and grow your costs by 10 times, you know?
Yep.
Massive
That's right.
Lever there.
That's right. All right.
We'll try and dig in, get the source data there.
I'm going to reach in the fishbowl. I got one last item here. I'm going to India. You can't hold me down. I'm going to India, baby. There's this Wall Street Journal piece by Megha Mandavia. 80% of the world's stock options aren't traded where you think, and where you don't think is India.
I thought India the whole time.
I was stat after stat in this piece was hitting me up the noggin. I was like, ooh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm, is what I kept doing when I was reading this. So India accounted for 78% of equity option contracts that were traded in 2023. 78%. India, that's stat number one. These are short term. Everybody's losing money. I mean, you knew that everyone was losing money when I talked about stock options to begin with, but everybody's losing money. There's this report from the Securities and Exchange Board, that's India's regulator. 9 out of 10 individual traders in equity futures lost the per capita income of India, the equivalent of the per capita. 90% of equity traders did this. That's 110,000 Indian rupees. So if you bring this to the US, our average per capita, I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I think it's somewhere around like 50 to 60K in the US. So that's if you said 90% of those that traded options in the US lost 50 to 60K. Another one. Retail traders held their options for less than 30 minutes on average. What? Like that one blew my mentals out my ear sockets. I don't even know if YOLO. I have ear sockets. YOLO? You say yellow?
YOLO.
30 minutes? So I read this. When I first read that last point, I went, okay. So this is a bunch of computers that are, you know, trying to replicate the Medallion Fund, and it's sophisticated firms, you know, that are actually trading. That's what my brain said. But then no, my friend. Here's the last thing I'll throw out. So there were 500,000 active derivative traders in 2019, 4 million in 2023. So volume, huge volume increase for number of traders. 36% of individual traders were between 20 and 30 years old. A little over a third between 20 and 30 years old. There are lots more than that happened over the past few years. They are holding these options for less than 30 minutes on average. They are losing the equivalent of the per capita income of India and represent 78% of equity option contracts worldwide.
People are so interesting, right? So for the longest time in America, we thought poorly of sports gambling. And then something changed in the last 3 years where it's basically on its way to being available everywhere. When you make a change like that, there are unintended consequences where I don't know what the numbers are, but some people get addicted to gambling and it absolutely destroys their life.
Yep.
The thought how we think about 30-minute options as somehow falling under the investing umbrella and not gambling. I mean, gosh, those odds you gave, it seems like it's gambling with much worse odds than going to Vegas.
Yes.
It's just bizarre. Like, because I would guarantee you that there are people in India who are just addicted to gambling, but it's under the umbrella of their investing account. And so somehow it's thought of differently. I'm just not sure how liberal we should be about options trading because no one makes money on it.
Not this liberal. I can tell you how liberal we shouldn't be is this liberal. I fully agree with your point. And this is I don't know if you are aware. I'm gonna give you one other stat. I'll quiz you. One quick quiz.
Okay.
In the last 8 years, how many of those years has the Indian stock market closed in the positive?
I'm going to go 6.
8. 8. So what this is I'm not going to say the word end. I don't mean to say that things are about to collapse, but I'm just saying like we're in, maybe I won't even use the word end. We are in India, a wave of positive stock returns. Like the stock market has gone up every year for the past 8 years.
Yeah.
When you look at the equity derivatives like volume chart, it's gone from it's to a point where don't even know what the number was in 2020 because it's so low on this chart. Whatever 4,000 billion is, I don't even know what 4,000 billion is a number.
4 trillion. It's 4 trillion.
4,000 billion. No, 4,000 billion is bigger than any other number I've ever thought about in my whole life. So
you're wrong. It's big.
it's big. If you say a number, that's wrong because it's bigger than that. But this is an explosion where now, to your point with gambling, people are like, the Indian stock market only goes up. That's the mentality that's happening right now in India, I'm sure, because we've been there in the U.S. We might still be there in the U.S. that the Indian stock market only goes up. So therefore, trading options is just a way to make more money off a thing that you can only make money off of.
Except
everyone's losing money. That's the only contradictory point.
I know that our podcast numbers in India aren't off the charts, but there are definitely some listeners. So feel free to hit us up, skippydoogles@gmail.com. We hope you aren't trading options. But if you are, maybe you're in the 10%, but that's not even true. But tell us about the options culture in India, please.
Yeah, it would be great.
Curious. I think your point, actually, you counterintuitively made a point that you might not have been trying to make. If the stock market goes up for 8 straight years, it becomes part of the dialogue that happens in the streets. People talk about investing more, and that drives more people to brokerage accounts. And when you go to brokerage accounts, if you have one friend that claims, I put claims in quotes because this probably isn't true, to have hit it big with options trading, then there's like this avalanche of desire to, one, make money in investing if everyone else is doing it, and two, make money as quickly as possible.
Exactly. That's it. That is, I think you're absolutely right. We talked probably, this might have been 2 or 3 years ago, probably 2 years ago. I was at the soccer field, and there is a couple next to me, right? We would talk to you all the time. And the wife of the couple was saying, oh, one of my friends trades options, makes $40,000 to $50,000 a day. I'm going to start trading options.
$40,000 to $50,000 a day.
I'm going to start trading options. And there was so much emotion and so many words that came into my head, but all I could say was, don't do that. And I don't know where that landed, to be honest. Well, I mean, I do know where it landed. I don't know specifically where it landed, but I know where that was going to land. But it's the same thing. It's because when the stock market gets to the point, to what you're saying, where it's just being discussed everywhere, going back to whatever JFK's dad, Joe, right? I think was JFK's dad, Joe and the shoeshine boy. When he was like, when he was talking about stocks, when he's giving me stock tips, I know it's over, right? That same thing.
So you're telling me that a week later at the soccer practice, you know how it ended, because they had like $300,000 of cash falling out of their pockets.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then exactly. The next week, there were just millions everywhere and new cars, new house.
And then extrapolate that.
$50,000 a day.
Who knows now? I mean, now. This is years later. But it is interesting.
They're on the list of the world's richest people. You don't even see them anymore.
Exactly.
It's like Elon Musk, Buffett, and this soccer family.
This is how the anecdotes turn into lore. Because I promise you, and I know you know this, I promise you, when she was saying $40,000 to $50,000 a day, that probably meant there were 2 days that this person talked to that other person where they happened for those 2 days to have made that amount of money. And the other days,
no, that's the way not even that. It's probably they lost money 85% of the time, had a couple days where they made $350, and somehow the storytelling, this is like catching a fish. The storytelling turned that $350 into 50.
With the way options work, you have to multiply by 100. that was way too wonky of a joke. I'm sorry.
Oh, all right. Anything else in your fishbowl? Don't turn to options, people. You'll regret it.
I got nothing else.
We will try and get you guys a show next week, but we have travel going on. We'll do our best. Reminder, all thanks for the show are skippydoogles.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye, everybody.